Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 16th of Shivat. We're going to see a couple of tshuvot, two of them by Moshe Feinstein that were interesting. First, we haven't seen Moshe Feinstein's tshuvot in a while, and also they were particularly interesting in terms of the topic that they take on. But it happens to be the Chatam Sofer on the 16th of Shivat of Tav Kuf Tzadi Gimel of 1833 also had a responsum in the fifth volume of Chatam Sofer in the Choshen Mishpat section, Simon Tzadi Dalet, responsum number 94. About a set of topics that we don't often get to, and I'm always trying to expand my horizons, so it was an opportunity to sort of delve into something that we don't often see together. Because in this case, the case was a question of shtarot. So shtarot means deeds or promissory notes. It's all sorts of written documents that either establish a contract or establish a sale or establish a loan or establish a promissory note. So they can have some monetary value. Well, there's not monetary value inherent to the document. It's by virtue of what's written on the document. So that's a shtar and shtarot have certain halachic statuses that we'll get to towards the end of the tshuva in terms of how you can be responsible for them or not. So if you have shtarot, and it could also be cash, or also thought of as shtarot, because it's the same kind of a thing, right? What we call dollar bills are really a piece of paper that's written on it. The government of the United States verifies that it's worth a dollar. So halachically, I'm pretty sure that counts as shtarot as well. So you have these shtarot, some kinds of documents that have some kind of monetary value. And the original person who had the shtarot gave them to a non-Jew. And he was a seller of shtarot. So how do you be a seller of shtarot? So let's say person A borrows $100 from person B, right? And they write a promissory note. I owe you $100. Now, let's suppose this person is a pretty trustworthy person. In 99% of the cases, he'll pay back the $100. So that promissory note isn't quite worth $100 because there's some chance that he won't pay it back. So it's not quite worth $100. In addition, if I want money now, right, and I only have a shtar, but I need the $100, I need money now, if I come to you and I say, listen, I'll give you the shtar, you're not going to give me $100 because you have to wait for it. Now, that's not an interest question because I'm not asking for it. It's not interest in the original loan. It's I want to sell it. So there's some discounting value. But there's nonetheless clearly value to these shtarot. So there was a person who sold shtarot. That's what he did, meaning I have money. It'd be like a pawn shop except with shtarot, with deeds, with, you know, with cash it wouldn't work, but with promissory notes, let's just use that term, with promissory mortgages or things like that. So he gives a bunch of shtarot, of such shtarot, to a non-Jew. And the reason is the non-Jew is thinking of buying them. So if I buy up, you know, at 40 cents on the dollar, then eventually if enough of them pay off, I make money. So the non-Jew is thinking about buying them up, and so he leaves them with them. Then the non-Jew eventually decides not to buy for whatever reason, and he sends them back to the Jew from whom he took them to look at them or to consider them with a Jewish messenger, a Na'ar Yisrael, a boy, he might have been a teenager, right, who the Jew who had originally given the shtarot to this non-Jew to look at often used him. So there's the reason why you mentioned that is so you can't claim, well, I never would have trusted that kid, you should have known better. So that's not going to be an issue. So the kid brings them back to the place of business, let's say, of this Jew who sells shtarot, and the Jew isn't there. But the man who is there is a partner of the Jews. Now, it doesn't say he's a partner in the shtarot business. He's a partner in other issues. But again, it's going to be a function of, and therefore, I'm not negligent by giving them to him because it's somebody that I had the right to expect that you trusted. But then before the Jew came back, let's say the Jew was on a business trip. By the time 2 weeks was up, let's say, when he got back, or 3 weeks, whatever it was, the second Jew, the Jewish partner, forgot what the shtarot were, didn't look at them carefully, and burned them. In the process of making some drink, right? He burned them to light the fire so he could drink some drink. So somebody has to pay something, right? Who's going to pay and for what and how? And that's the question that comes to the Chatam Sofer. So what do we do about this? So there's a couple of kinds of questions that come up. One kind of question is there liability for burning shtarot? So that Chatam Sofer starts off. So let's say I know that these shtarot are yours, and I just walk into a room, and I decide to take your shtarot, and I throw them in the fire. So then I am chayev, but I am liable because of what's called dina de garmi. So dina de garmi is a complicated halachic topic. I Rav Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, had a series of shiurim that he gave on Dina Degarmi and Yeshivat Haritzion. Some of his students wrote up their notes from the shiurim and published it as one of the volumes, meaning when Rav Lichtenstein passed away, he didn't leave much in volume form of his own writings. There's a couple of volumes in English, and the yeshiva has put out, I think, two volumes of articles he's written in Hebrew, but one of his big legacies, as it were, was that the students of various shiurim later in his life wrote up the shiurim, and you have a sense that they're feel to me, I wasn't in the shiurim, but they feel to me. I went through them in the year that he passed away, and I summarized them. They appear online at Torah Musings somewhere. You can get them. I think Gil Sudan actually put them into a small little PDF book that you can download for free or get for free. Anyway, but Dina Degarmi was one of the topics. Dina Degarmi is the question of indirect damages, and when I damage somebody indirectly, at what point am I or am I not liable? So burning a shtar, right? You have an IOU, you have a mortgage that somebody owes you money on their house, and it's the only evidence you have of it, and I burn it. So the item that I burn isn't worth very much money. The paper's worth, you know, pennies probably. So if it's parchment, it might be worth dollars. But it said on it that somebody owed you $10,000, and now you don't have no way of collecting the $10,000. Even if that person were to admit it, right, if you have to collect from a lien, anyway, it damages the person who had the shtar. So, Dina Degarmi is an obligation. So the fact that the shtar were burned, whoever would be liable for burning them would have to pay Mitan Dina Degarmi. Now that might be a halacha in the Torah, it might be a Doraita halacha, it might be a Rabbanan halacha. Whatever it is, there's a financial liability there. Question is, who's going to be liable for burning them? Meaning, if we know the partner burned them, so you think he would be liable. But if somebody's liable before that for having not watched them appropriately, he might be the one who's liable. And then the person who burned them would be liable to that person. So when it comes to a shomer shtarot, somebody who's watching over shtarot for other people, Kaimalan Haskamata Shach, the Shach held, and we hold this way, says the Chatam Sofer, that a Shomer is Chayev Bipshia. If a Shomer, the reason is, now let's say I'm watching Shtarot for you, and not that I burn them on purpose, but they got burned. So they got burned. That'll then be a function of that. You could say, well, I'm not liable because they don't have any inherent value. The answer is it's Dina Degarmi. I would be liable because the damage that occurred to them causes you damage indirectly, but not indirectly enough that we consider it non-liable. So there'll be a financial liability there. But that's only true if they got damaged and burned and destroyed in a way that I'm liable for. So, for example, if I was watching them as well as I could, right, and a hurricane came and blew the house off of me, and the shtarot got whisked away in this hurricane wind, and it was no warning ahead of time. So that's going to be completely out of my power. And if I'm a shomer, if I'm watching it for you, and I'm not a borrower is a whole different issue, then I should be liable. I shouldn't be liable because it's an onus. So the question is, what is a shomer of a shtarot going to be liable for? So the shach said he's clearly liable for pshia. Right? And pshia, says the Chasam Sofer, pshia is negligence. So this is going to be negligence because the partner forgot what it was about, forgot what the shtar were about, and burned them. So that's at best negligence. And we hold, says the Chasam Sofer, that negligence is kimazik bayadayim. So here, the person actually was mazik bayadayim. It's actually, he did damage it by his hands. But the point is, he didn't know what he was doing when he damaged it. But it, nonetheless, because it was negligent, it's considered damaging it directly. So now we have to figure out, where does the chain of liability go back to? So, for example, let's say the partner refuses to pay and you can't collect from him. Can I blame somebody prior to that in the chain of giving it for also having been negligent? Meaning, if the teenager should not have given it to the partner, then I could say to the teenager, well, you owe me the money for because you were negligent, and being negligent is as if you're destroying it. Meaning, let's say the teenager, instead of giving it to the partner, had given it, had put it in an elephant cage, and the elephant had destroyed it. So if the teenager is a shomer and is liable for negligence, because it's like he destroyed it, like he himself destroyed it, then he'd be liable for this too. So if I can define the giving it up to the partner as negligence, then that'll work as well. So just to pause and make clear, this comes up a lot in questions of damages. We have to figure out what was the damage. And then once we figure out what was the damage, we figure out if there's liability for that damage. And then when we figure out that there is liability for that damage, we have to figure out who it is who's liable. So that's what we have here. We have the burning of a shtar isn't actually direct damage because the shtar itself doesn't have monetary value. It's indirect damage because of the monetary value that's spoken of within the shtar that is legally enforceable. That's a second step monetary damage, but it is liable for that because of Dina de Karmi. Then the question becomes, who's liable for that damage? You would say clearly the man who burned it would be liable, but we need to know who's liable first, because then the original Jew who gave the shtar to the Nachri, to the non-Jew, would go to that first person, collect from them, and it would be their job to try to claim that they collected from the person later on down the road. So the burning of it, right, is negligent, and shomrim, and people who watch things, are liable for negligence. So now the question is who? So when it comes to the Nachri, to the non-Jew, there's actually a debate about that. When I give a non-Jew, if I give anybody, if I give them something to look at because they're thinking of buying it and they're watching it for me, so some hold it like a shomer sachar because you get the value of holding on to it and having it in their possession and looking at it, whatever, and some held it like a shomer chinam. A shomer chinam is a person who watches something for me just as a favor. Right? That's a shomer chinam. There's no monetary, there's no value to it. And they obviously are liable at a much lower level, meaning, you know, if I pay somebody to watch something for me, his obligation of watching, and therefore what's considered negligent or what's considered not full enough watching that he would be liable for the loss, that's going to be at a higher level than if I haven't paid him. Right? If I just ask to pay for a friend, he's still got to do something. He can't be negligent, but his obligations and his level of duty is clearly much lower. So the Nachri, the non-Jew, some people held he was a Shomer Sachar, would have held he was a Shomer Sachar. He was like, I was paying him by virtue of him being able to hold on to it and look at it and examine it. The teenager in between is clearly a Shomer Chinam. So now there's actually a whole debate in Halacha about if you have a person who's considered a Shomer Sachar, who's being paid to watch it, and he gives the item that's being watched to a Shomer Chinam to convey it to the person, there are those who hold that that's considered negligence itself. They hold it's considered negligence itself, even if the Shomer Chinam in the middle is somebody trusted by the original person. So let's say I'm the Jew giving these shtarot, these promissory notes to the non-Jew. I give them to the non-Jew, and then the non-Jew goes to a boy who works in my store and who I'll leave in charge of my store sometimes. Right? And he says to him, here, bring these back to your employer. So you might have thought to yourself, well, I can't complain to the non-Jew about having done that because he knows correctly that I trust this guy. So the answer halakhically, though, is that if the non-Jew or anybody, if the first shomer, the first person watching the item is being paid to do so, then to give that to somebody who's not being paid to do so is considered negligent halakhically because it leaves it in the hands of somebody with less of a stake in watching it. Right, that's called Girue Gar'e Lishmirato. You're lowering the level of watching it by virtue of doing that, and therefore that's considered negligence. And that would mean that the real person who's liable to me would be to the person who left the promissory notes would be the original non-Jew, because he was the first step of negligence. But now, so the Chatam Sofer points out, like kind of an odd halacha here, because the truth is that in this situation, both the Shomer Sachar and the Shomer Chinam would only be liable if the promissory notes got damaged by negligence. So that would suggest that on this particular halacha issue, they're the same. The answer doesn't matter. Since a Shomer Sachar has more obligations than a Shomer Chinam, it's considered a lowering of the level of shmirah, the level of watching that is being put onto it. And therefore, the first shomer, the first person watching, can be considered negligent and can be blamed for, can be not blamed, meaning can be financially liable for it by virtue of that. And that's a halacha that's paskened in Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat, Reish Sadi Aleph, in terms of shmirah. But if we hold that first shomer was a shomer chinam, if that first nifkad, that non-Jew was a shomer chinam, was not being paid for, it was not considered to be paying for it, then by giving it to the na'ar, to the teenager, he hadn't done anything wrong. And since this is a teenager who is trusted by the original Jew and every day leaves things with this teenager, then the first shomer goes away. He has no liability here because he didn't do anything wrong. And therefore, you can't take money out of him to pay back for it. Now, when it comes to the na'ar, if he gave it to the partner, when he gave it to the partner, right, who's eventually going to burn them, when he gave it to the partner, if the partner accepted it also like a Shomer Chinam, also like somebody watching it with a halachic standard of watching it in the same way, then the Na'ar also is fine because he gave it to somebody who has the exact same level of responsibility for it as he does. But, and then that would mean that the partner is the one who's liable because he was the one of Poshea who was negligent by virtue of burning it, by deciding to burn it. That would be Dina de Garmi. He has caused the other partner indirect damage, but indirect damage in a financially liable way in Halach, and he would have to pay it back. But there's something that can happen that would make that partner not a Shomer Chinam. So what would make that partner not a Shomer Chinam? So, but there's a way, as I said, there's a way that you can become not a Shomer. And that would be, let's say somebody comes to me and says, could you watch something for me? And I don't say yes. What I say is, put it down. And I don't mean yes. I say, just put it down there. So that doesn't involve, halakhically, necessarily any acceptance of responsibility. If you say to me, can you watch this for me? And I say, yes. By doing that, I've accepted certain halakhic responsibility, even though I'm not going to get paid for it. I've expected basically the responsibility not to be negligent about it. So negligence would be, let's say, you know, I said yes, and then I left and forgot it there. And by the time I got back, somebody had taken it. That would probably be negligence, right? So that's not allowed. But let's say I just said, oh, put it down. Now, put it down doesn't necessarily qualify as agreeing to watch it. So if that's what happened, now this, I just want to say, this becomes a complicated question of what happens when halacha says one thing and people don't know halacha well, and when they don't know halacha well, they do things and they think they're okay and they turn out not to be okay. Sometimes they can bear financial consequence for that. So this poor nar, this boy, might bear the responsibility because he might not realize that the partner wasn't agreeing. Meaning, you know, he walks into the partnership office and he says, this is for, this. He says, this is for your partner so-and-so. And the guy says, all right, put it down. That doesn't involve an acceptance of responsibility. And then later, when the guy picks them up and burns them because he wants to light a fire to make himself some drink, as the case happened, maybe the nar will be liable because he gave it to somebody who did not have the same level of responsibility as him. And that's a violation of Shmirah as well. That's a violation of the obligations that one takes on when one becomes a Shomer, when one watches an item for somebody else. So that's where the Na'ar might get himself in trouble. And then he can come back to this partner and say, but you owe me because you burned them, right? You actively burned them and you destroyed them. So the partner could theoretically take an oath, if it's true, he could take an oath that says, I didn't realize they were worth anything. I didn't know there was any value written in the Shtarot. I didn't know what they were. You told me they were paper, so I dropped, put them down, and then they were like junk mail, and I burned them. And if that were true, the poor teenager would be on the line for it, right? He would be on the line for it, and then he would not also get paid back from this other guy. Now, there is another wrinkle that I'm going to skip over basically because I want to get to the other tshuvot of Rav Moshe Feinstein. But the final wrinkle is that there are certain categories in halacha where the usual rules of shmirah don't apply and of financial responsibility don't apply. When it comes to avadim, to slaves, to karkaot, to landed property, to hekdesh, to that which belongs to Beit HaMikdash, and to shtarot. So there's halachos of whether or not you have to take a shvuah, an oath about them, and whether or not shomrim have the same halacha. What about those who watch items for other people of the same halachot? So it gets into an issue, but fundamentally there's a possibility that when it comes to a shtar, even a poshea shouldn't be liable. But here in our case, the Chasam Sofer, that's the opinion, not the Shachat said you were. I think he's quoting Pnei Yehoshua, says you weren't, but the Chasam Sofer says, but it's not. But here, if you take something and take possession of it for yourself, that already, even in a shtar, will make clear and will make it obvious and true that you're liable for it. So when the partner picked it up to put it into the fire to light for his drink, right? To light for his drink, so that makes he took it for his own. And once you take it for yourself, that's called shlichut yad. You took it on your own and for yourself. Once you've done that, you're liable. So that's the end of that shuvah in the Chatzim Sofer. So basically, it's going to depend on what the partner said when the na'ar brought him the shtarot. If he said to him, yes, I'll take charge of them, then he's the only one who's liable, and he's liable to his partner, have to work it out with each other. But if he said to him, just put him down, so then he might not be liable directly to the partner, and then the partner might be able to go, assuming that the teenager has money to pay the bank, he might go to him first, and the teenager can go to the partner who burned them and claim the money. That partner who burned them might be able to get out of it if he could swear, we hope truthfully, they didn't realize they were worth anything. They didn't realize they had any value. And then possibly, if you can swear they didn't have value, but if you knew they had value, then eventually he'll have to pay for them too, because even if it were true that shtarot, that for promissory notes and for documents and deeds and written papers that create monetary value by virtue of what's written on them, not by themselves, so there, it might be that you require shlichut yad. It might be that you require that the person take possession of them in order for him to be liable, but that seems to have been true here. So that's a first tshuva that gets us a taste, reminds us of what it means to adjudicate monetary questions that can become very thorny and very complicated in terms of assigning liability when things go wrong and when people make mistakes and there's loss of money involved, and you have to figure out who's liable for what, when, and where. That's our first tshuva for the 16th of Shvat. But now I have two tshuvot of Moshe Feinstein from the 1960s that I also thought were really interesting. So in Yoredeya Chelek Bet Simon Dalet, the second time he published response on Yoredeya issues in the fourth responsum, this is from the 16th of Shvat of Tufshin Chaf Gimel of 1963 to Rav Nota Tzvi Greenblatt. I think it was an important Rav in Memphis. So this is going to touch on a topic we've touched the last 2 days, and I try not to repeat myself over and over, but here I think Rav Moshe Feinstein brings up an issue that's new in this context. That's why I wanted to get to it. You had a shochet, you had a ritual slaughterer. So those who have been with me in the previous days will remember that ritual slaughterers who violate Shabbos in public can't be considered a reasonable shochet because he's a public Sabbath violator. So he's a public Sabbath violator, then he can't slaughter for the, he can't ritually slaughter to produce kosher meat. So here's the question. He davens in a shul, this ritual slaughter, this shochet. He davens in a shul on Shabbos and Yontif in Yom Kippur, and he was the chazan, and he used a microphone. And it was in public. So now he says, but that doesn't matter, I'm not a public Sabbath violator, because the rabbi before this rabbi, before the rabbi's in town now, the old rabbi told me, and the rabbi in this shul, they say it's allowed. So we claim to be an Orthodox shul. So in the 1960s, you had this situation where you'd have Orthodox shuls, or shuls that claim to be Orthodox, claim to be Shomer Torah Mitzvos, but used a microphone. I will say, not that Rav Moshe Feinstein addresses it, I'm not saying he should have, because Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was much younger than him. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has tshuvot about microphones and radios, where he's not nearly as sure as Rav Moshe Feinstein in this tshuva is that they are Sabbath violations. So Rav Moshe says it's not a claim. Now, he's talking about America. He says it's not a claim that you thought it was okay, and therefore you're a shogeg, right? You don't realize you're violating Shabbat. If you don't realize you're violating Shabbat, then this whole halacha that would invalidate him as a ritual slaughterer wouldn't apply. Rav Moshe says it doesn't matter because the Hagudas HaRabbanim, right, says that who are the Torah giants, and they are the majority of important Torah scholars in our time, they have made public that you can't use a microphone. And therefore, there's no room to make a mistake and say, well, I follow this Rav who's lenient about this issue, even if he gave reasons for it. Meaning this Rav gives reasons, he writes a tshuva, he writes a response, and he says, here's the reasons, but it doesn't matter because the majority and the important rabbanim of the time have already made clear that this is considered Sabbath violation, and therefore Moshe Feinstein says, this shochet has to be considered a mechalel b'mezid. So that's a crucial, important issue to point out. What counts as deliberate when you will claim that you have halachic authorities that you're relying on? So I think a lot of people would say, well, if you have a reputable authority that you're relying on, then the fact that other people disagree doesn't make you a deliberate Sabbath violator for following your authority. And Rabbi Moshe Feinstein saying, if there's enough of a consensus among the great rabbis of a generation that something is a certain qualifies as a certain kind of Torah violation, so that's a big problem. So that's interesting point number one. Moshe Feinstein's of the opinion that a consensus can mean that you do not, that not you, that a person does not have the right to follow a minority opinion and claim that that makes it okay in terms of Sabbath violation. Therefore, not only, see, this is the key point, not only is it Sabbath violation to use the microphone, Moshe Feinstein saying, it's deliberate Sabbath violation. It's willful Sabbath violation, even if this person says, now, it's unclear to me what Rav Moshe Feinstein would hold if the person says, I never knew the Agudas HaRabbanim said such a thing. I never knew that the consensus of poskim is that you can't, and I only knew what this rabbi said. To me, that would complicate the question a little bit. But Rav Moshe Feinstein, I think, is not talking about these things. Everybody knows that Orthodox Jews understand you can't use a microphone, and you're following one minority opinion, so that is considered deliberate and willful, not unintentional. That's a key question that would come up in lots and lots of areas, even into our times, of what we're allowed to do and when, and who we're allowed to follow about what kinds of things. So a very, very important issue. That's why I thought it was interesting. But then he goes on to say, but I don't think you can qualify this person in Mechal Shabbos for Hesya in public. I think you have to qualify it as violating Shabbat in private. Why? Because the community that he's within, they all also use the microphone. That's why they daven there, right? They daven there and they say the microphone is okay. And they probably assume that he doesn't know that he's doing anything wrong, right? They'll assume, I think, that he doesn't realize that the majority opinion, the consensus of Orthodox halachic decisors is that you can't use this microphone on Shabbos and Yom Tov because they'll figure he's relying on their rabbi like they are. So even if it's true that he knows that the consensus is, and therefore he counts as willful violation, but he also knows that this tzibur would think of him as, at worst, an unwitting Sabbath violator, and therefore it doesn't count as being over b'farhesya ella mezid b'tzina. Now that also is a crucial comment that has many, many ramifications. So let's say in our times, somebody lives in a community where everybody violates ex halacha, and this person who's also going to violate the ex halacha because he wants to, or because it's enjoyable, or because he figures he'll fit in with the community, knows that the consensus of Orthodox people is that you're not allowed to do that, but he says, but my community would do that. So let's say eating fish out, let's suppose there's a shul where everybody in that shul eats fish out. And let's even say the rabbi in that shul says, I think it's okay to eat fish out for whatever reasons he gives. So I know that most Orthodox Jews don't. I know that most Orthodox rabbis say you can't, and I do it anyway. So Moshe is saying, first of all, you can't say that you're an unwitting transgressor. It's not true. You're a willful, deliberate transgressor of the Torah because you know that the consensus of Psak goes against you. But you're not considered doing it in public because you're only doing it around and with those who think that it's either okay or think that you think it's okay because you have a Rav who passed in that way before you. And now, if this person is also doing it because he makes a living off of it by being a chaz, right? Not only is a shochet, he's a chazin, so that also makes him like a mumar l'te'avon, and it makes him like somebody who's violating the Torah only because he benefits from it. And we usually say that somebody who violates the Torah in private because he benefits from it is considered okay, can perform ritual slaughter. But if somebody is a mumar l'te'avon, they lose their trustworthiness in terms of checking their knife, because we know that they're a person who, when it's inconvenient, won't bother. When it's inconvenient, they won't bother to do the inconvenient thing, right? They'll in this case use the microphone because it's convenient. So he's a mumar l'te'avon because they make a living from it. So since he makes a living, he goes and does it. So that person loses some of their trustworthiness, and therefore we're gonna have to have somebody check his knife going into the future. But all that, Rav Moshe says, is only before they warn him that he's not allowed to use the microphone when he davens. He's not allowed to daven with the microphone on Shabbos and Yom Tov because he can make this mistake that, since everybody knows that, perhaps everybody knows, but they all think he's a shogeg, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But once the community comes to him and says, listen, you're davening shul whether you use the microphone, consensus of Orthodox decisors is you're not allowed to use the microphone on Shabbos and Yom Tov, when you're doing this, it's considered willful violation, and therefore going forward into the future, you're going to be a mechal Shabbos in public, and therefore you're no longer going to be able to ritual slaughterer. From that point on, he'll already be considered a mechal Shabbos for Hesya. Even if we don't see him do it, since we know that it's happening, because we know that he's the chazan in the shul, therefore, so if he stops today from davening with a microphone, then he could still do the shechita, as long as somebody stands over him and watches him and checks his knife, because he's no longer trustworthy in these kinds of things, because we know he violates Shabbos. So that is the tshuva. And again, I'm less interested in the particular issues that he raised, and the particular question of whether this show can continue or not, because we've seen that a lot of times, and I don't want to repeat myself. I was more interested for the issues that he brings up in terms of whether or not following one rabbi's psak is allowed in halacha, and what that counts you as. If it's a violation of halacha, as far as everybody else concerns, whether that counts you as being willful or deliberate, and then whether it counts as public or private, depending on the community in which you're violating. Those were broader issues that Rav Moshe Feinstein brought up that I thought were worth our while to consider. I have just a short while left. There's this other tshuva from Moshe. This is in Orach Chaim, the fifth time he came to the Orach Chaim issues, response number 42, where he talks about etrogei shmita shiyatu l'chutz la'aretz. If you have etrogim that were grown in Eretz Yisrael during a shmita year by people who believe in the heter mechira, in other words, there are those who in Israel, many, including the chief rabbinate, who think that you're allowed to halachically sell the land of Israel for the Shemitah year, and once it's sold to a non-Jew, that allows for all sorts of growing activities to go on, agricultural activities to go on, because the land belongs to a non-Jew, and the claim is that removes the whole issue of Shemitah from that land that belongs to the non-Jew. So many, many Jews, especially in the more, whatever the right word would be, right-wing Haredi world, don't think this is an acceptable thing to do or an appropriate thing to do. And therefore, you would say to yourself that these are Shemitah Etrokim that are coming outside of Eretz Yisrael, and what do you do about them? Because, first of all, Shemitah produce is not supposed to come outside of Eretz Yisrael, and secondly, it's Shemitah produce, so what do you do with it? So the tshuva is not that long, but I just ran out of time because I got caught up in my financial issues in the Chatam Sofer. I just want to point out that Rav Moshe says he thinks there's room to export it, even though we think that it might be Shemitah produce, but he does think you're not allowed to buy it directly because you have to treat it as like a Shemitah produce, and that would mean that you buy it with the lulav and the other, and the arba minim, and the other, right, the hadassim thereof. You buy all four of the species that you're going to get, you buy them together, and you put the price on the whole thing, not on the etrog itself. That's interesting because most of the time today when I buy etrogim, when we buy etrogim, you pay for the etrog, and they throw everything else in for free, as it were. Or at least they throw in, let's say, the lulav for say. If Moshe Feinstein's saying in the Shemitah year, you'd have to do it the other way. You'd have to pay for the lulav and get the etrog thrown in for free. But other than that, he thinks it's okay for various reasons I can't get into. More than that, he says, not only is it okay, he thinks it's better than other kinds of etrogim, and therefore you should buy from them, even though those people, now that's another case where those people are relying on a psak that he thinks isn't necessarily the correct psak, but nonetheless, since they're relying on a psak that here he thinks that it's a reputable psak, it's a possible psak, and also for other reasons, he thinks you are allowed to and should prefer to buy these etrogim. So that's three tshuvot for a responsible day for the 16th of Shvat, the Chatam Sofer on the burning of Shtarot and the chain of liability for damages that occur. Rav Moshe Feinstein on what qualifies as a accidental or an unintentional violation of the Torah and when it's in public, when it's in private. And then Rav Moshe quickly on etrogim in a Shemitah year sold by grown under the permissibility of Heter Mechira. Have a good day.